Good morning, Tampa Bay, and welcome to the Morning Edge. I'm Floyd J. Winters, and here is Augie.
Well, good morning again to Tampa Bay. We are redundant in our message, but we welcome you to the Morning Edge, and I thank you for coming on. We're going to be talking about Cuba this morning. We got the monthly guest in Johannes Werner, who does a little thing down in SLR, a five-mile radius station, but we want to give him a little more broadcast from Clearwater clear down to Venice, and when our signal is clear, but we want that to be known, and we want you to call in and ask any and all questions, 941-745-1490. In the interim, before we get to that, we were in the parade of brutality and police killings of blacks, because another one happens through a man's spine being severed to the extent that he dies after 9 days and 10 days of non-reporting for the inspection in Baltimore. You remember that? There was a play about that very issue in Baltimore about blacks and whites all the way back. I'm trying to think, Mamma Mia. I think that might have been it. But anyway, it's an old history. But now Baltimore enters the parade of killings. You've got Baltimore. We've got Cleveland, we got Ferguson, we got Chicago, we got New York, Staten Island, Sarasota, Florida, and who knows what's next? And I'm sure I've missed a few, but it's an epidemic.
Sarasota, Florida?
That's right.
Killing?
A killing. A sheriff's deputy shot a black boy through his windshield in the seat of his car because he said he was threatened by the car, and he shot right through the glass, killing the kid in the driver's seat. And the arguments the witness were there was no such a threat to the police officer.
This is the guy who jumped on the hood of the car and shot through the windshield?
Yeah.
Is that a different one?
That's the one.
Was that Sarasota, though?
That was Sarasota.
Okay, it happened just recently.
Well, not that recently, but...
There was one that happened recently where they were chasing someone. They allegedly, the car tried to hit the cops, so the cops somehow managed to jump on the hood of the car.
Well, the car was moving, right?
Well, yeah, it was a strange case.
What a balancer
he was. He thought that the car was going to hit him, so he jumped on the hood of the car and shot through the windshield.
I suppose he had a video going showing that ballet effort he was making, don't you think?
That was remarkable.
I think that we've got talented artists in the form of... a police officer can stand on the hood of a car while it's moving at them. I mean, that would mean you'd flip over the backside and end up on the street, I would think. But, we've got this latest one now. Late last night, there's a report of a woman videotaping several police departments all lined up around people laying on the ground being under some kind of arrest. This woman's videotaping. I think this is in California. California, Rodney King. Remember Rodney King? That was one of the first videotapes. But in any case, she was videotaping, and one of the police officers came up to him and came up to her and grabbed her video out of her hand, turned around and slammed it and stepped on it and broke it. Fortunately for us and for her, there was someone videotaping her. So when you go out and videotape the police, you better have a backup, somebody videotaping your presence. But I think we have maybe our guest.
We have our guest. Welcome to the Morning Edge. Is this Johan?
This is Johannes.
Johannes, would you give us your short bio on yourself to remind people?
Let's make sure that his voice is...
We're getting good voice here, are we?
Yes.
He seems pretty far away right at the moment.
Well, I'm as far as Sarasota, Florida.
There you go. Okay. You do a show on SLR, a low-range FM station, 96.5. And you do that when, Johannes?
I'm running the Florida Caribe show every other Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 96.5 WSLR LPFM in Sarasota.
So you might have done one yesterday?
I did not one yesterday.
But next Tuesday, perhaps.
Next Tuesday. So. And I'm dedicating most of my professional resources and energy to Cuba as editor of Cuba Standard.
Mm-hmm. Cuba Standard.
Now, you might want to explain that a little bit. I know Johannes very well. He's a member. He's a secretary for the organization I founded called the Southwest Coalition for Peace and Justice, Southwest Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, which we now have hopes is going to go on just fine. in any event, you want to tell us a little about your business and what that entails, and then lead us into the pathway of what's happening, what's really happening in Cuba.
Well, I've been covering the Cuban economy since 1998. I started this when I moved to Florida because it seemed so obvious that there's this market of 11 million people next door to Florida and the United States, yet there are no trade relations, and that this was going to be changing very quickly. But everybody knows we're still in the middle of U.S. sanctions against Cuba. And now the United States has begun to ease up on that. And that puts Cuba's standard into an interesting position. We are the only independent information service exclusively focused on the Cuban economy, and therefore interest among business people around the globe is rising in Cuba.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction right there. What do you think about Obama's latest move to remove Cuba from the terrorist list?
Well, this is part of his larger positioning in ending 50 years of punishing Cuba for the revolution. The taking off of the terror list is one of the steps the executive can take to ease U.S. sanctions against Cuba, and it is an important political signal. It actually put Obama in a quite good position at the recent Summit of the Americas in Panama. That's because our Latin American friends have been pushing the United States for the past two or three decades to end this embargo, and they see this as a clear signal that Washington is moving in that direction. So the terrorist list, taking off Cuba, the terrorist list is an important step, but it is at this point a more symbolical step than an actual practical step. In other words, if you're a bank or if you're a business, it's not going to make a big difference if you want to do business with Cuba.
Now, in place of that being on a terrorist list, I understand that Venezuela now has replaced Cuba.
And no, this is a different step. The United States has issued sanctions against seven Venezuelan officials.
So they're individual sanctions rather than...
These are individuals, and they will not be allowed to do any financial transactions with the United States, and they're not allowed to travel to the United States. So this is on a lower level than the Cuba sanctions.
Well, speaking about traveling, Governor Cuomo from New York just went to Cuba this week. What do you think about that?
Well, this is part of... I don't know how to put this... Cuba is fashionable right now in the United States. It's almost like a fad. And U.S. delegations are tripping over each other in Cuba right now. There are lots of politicians traveling. You have Congress people traveling to Cuba. You have governors traveling to Cuba. Everybody is going right now. And the most prominent recent group is the group from New York State that is there right now trying to spin new business. What sets Cuomo and his delegation apart is the high caliber of businesses represented in his delegation.
Which of those businesses is would you say is the most significant, or do you know?
There are several financial players there. I don't think there is anyone that really stands out. They're all sizable operations representing corporate interests. And I will highlight one if they really make a move, if they invest, if they put money behind plans to eventually do business with Cuba. But at this point, I wouldn't highlight a specific company.
A lot of it, I think, is agriculture. Cuomo is even pushing milk from New York. And there's a lot of states that are interested in selling and buying, but especially selling to the Cuban market. The one state, however, that's a little bit apprehensive is our own state, Florida, because we're afraid of how that may concern us and how what the spinoff would be on that. But a lot of it has been agriculture, but I'm sure there'll be other products to follow. Any kind of knowledge on that area?
This is not new. U.S. states, U.S. agribusinesses have been selling their products to Cuba since 2001. We're the largest supplier of agricultural goods to Cuba. And we're selling to the tune of about $400 to $500 million worth of agricultural products.
So we've been doing business with Cuba to the tune of $400 million a year, more than anyone else or more than who?
This is the largest, as I said, we're the largest agricultural goods supplier to Cuba of any country. We're, in the bigger picture, about the third largest supplier of goods. U.S. policy has restricted U.S. exports to agricultural goods, which is why we're stuck in third or fourth place. But even with that restriction, the United States is already a fairly large supplier of agricultural goods. How does this impact Florida? I would argue that Florida is very far behind, given its potential of selling agricultural goods and food to Cuba, because of political restraint.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that, I mean, the word is that, frankly, the older Cubans are dying and the younger Cubans don't care. The issue of what's happening here politically is going to be demonstrated in this next couple of years going in, or almost 2 years, going into the next election, and with Rubio stepping forward, the man who can't make up his mind whether he exported himself from Cuba and was born here or what. But in any event, he's going to use his Latin language and his experience to try to promote himself to the presidency. So that influence is there. And then you have the situation, the big kahunas, or whatever you want to call it, going on right now is what's happening with the medical industry of Cuba, because it has become an industry of education, of export of a different kind, and where is all of that, Johannes?
That's a very broad question. Where should I start? Should I start with Rubio?
I know I used Rubio as a.
I think we're making too much of Rubio.
Well,
the political situation in Florida is already evident to insiders. Cuba is a political loser for you if you are arguing in favor of sanctions. Jeb Bush has realized that, and Rubio will also have to tone down or compensate in other ways. What we've seen in past presidential elections is Obama actually won South Florida. He won Miami, and in part because of a swing of Cuban-American voters in his favor. And what positioned him as a popular politician among Cuban Americans is the fact that he wanted to allow free travel to Cuba by Cuban Americans. That made him eminently popular among Cuban Americans. I think we were just making too much about a small group of elected officials and other politicians who are arguing in favor of sanctions. There's not very much of that going on anymore.
It's my understanding that the ultimate swinger for Obama in both elections was the I-4 corridor. The Puerto Ricans, not the Cubans, are becoming a very large factor, aren't they?
That's correct, but I would argue that Cuban Americans in Miami actually helped him get elected this time around.
Oh, really? So they made a difference that that's not been made mention of enough, and certainly not by Obama.
One person who knows that very well is Tampa Representative Kathy Castor, the Democrat representing Tampa in Congress, has positioned herself very strongly in favor of normalizing relations with Cuba. And this has helped her in manifold ways. She's getting votes from Cuban Americans in the Tampa area, and she's getting a lot of campaign contributions. This position is eminently popular among the Chamber of Commerce crowd, the port, the airport, and she's even getting campaign contributions from people in Miami, even though she doesn't represent them, because of her Cuba positioning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a quite interesting political situation right now. It's not totally obvious yet, but insiders understand that normalizing relations with Cuba is a political winner, even in Florida now.
Well, that's an interesting situation. So we're going to see a change in the political landscape, maybe in the next presidential election, that Cuba may not be a big issue. It may be more of a hot potato for people to go for sanctions, and you may see them kind of avoiding that. I'm sure there'll be people on the campaign trail, the old-timers who still survive in Cuba. Johan, I think we have a caller. Do you mind taking a call?
Sure.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air at 1490. Do you have a question for our guest today?
Yes, I do.
Your name?
This is Pat.
Hi, Pat. Welcome.
I was in a discussion the other day, and they said that Cubans generally do not have good health care for their own people. There's like two classes. The rich get their coverage, and the poor don't get coverage. And I thought that was a little preposterous because I've heard so much about the good health care in Cuba. So I just wondered if there are indeed two classes of people who get health care, or if everyone gets it. And I'll take my answer off air.
Thank you, Pat.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for the question. I don't think that Cuban health care is bad. On the contrary, for the average Cuban, my friends, for instance, who make about $40 a month in salaries, are very well covered in terms of the more serious conditions they're facing. My friend Rafael, for instance, is facing a diabetic condition, and it's become very serious over the past few years. But everything is taken care of with some of the most advanced medicine. Now, what you're facing in many cases is lacking medicine, basic medicine, you know, the over-the-counter stuff that we so easily get at CVS and Walgreens and all these other places. That's not so easy to come by in Cuba. But I think the Cuban healthcare system has one of the best reaches of any healthcare system in this hemisphere, and it's particularly good for the most vulnerable people, I would argue. Okay. Now, what's confusing the discussion is Cuba is also focusing very much right now on healthcare tourism. They're trying to attract people suffering serious conditions or not so serious conditions, such as dental work, to Cuba and have their procedures done for hard currency. And that may give the impression that, you know, if you own dollars, if you're willing to spend them, you will be better off. But I would argue that's not the case.
Here's an interesting thing. On Governor Cuomo's visit this week to Cuba, along with him came the representatives from the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. They have a relationship with Cuba, an agreement with the Center of Molecular Immunology in Havana to develop a vaccine for lung cancer. So we're talking there about some heavy research right there in Cuba in the medical industry.
That's right. Cuba has focused a lot of resources over the past 20 years or so on cutting-edge pharmaceuticals and biotechnology. Much of it is going into cancer research, and another big bunch is going into diabetes research. And they've come up with some groundbreaking drugs, some groundbreaking vaccines that some players in the United States find very attractive and would like to get a hold on. Cuba has, for instance, offered to the United States a diabetic foot drug they've developed. It's unique in the world, and it would save limbs and lives in the thousands in the United States.
What kind of drug?
Was available.
What kind of drug is this now again?
This is a drug, I'm not a medical expert, but it helps prevent and cure diabetic foot. These are side effects of symptoms of diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, they
it causes hundreds of thousands of people to lose limbs in mm-hmm. all over the world.
Well, diabetes is out of control on people, one of the early indicators is heavy weight, and then when you try to lose that, then you suffer side effects, and maybe that's one of them.
That's right, and Cuba has a high percentage of diabetes sufferers, as most Caribbean countries have. It's not exactly clear why. Maybe it's the presence of sugar cane, and mm-hmm. sugar consumption. But it's a fact, and therefore the Cuban system has focused very much on a cure for diabetes, or at least a cure for the worst symptoms of diabetes.
Well,
and that's one of those examples.
The thing that Pat brought up was the two-stage system. You're saying while the lower end of society gets all the care that they need, it's the higher cost care, but what do Cuban doctors charge for an annual salary? Are they anything approaching the United States? Is the hospital care somehow a cost that's borne by others for poor people coming in, like we do with our emergency wards we have in this country? What's the relationship there?
Well, I don't think you can say Cuban doctors charge something. What you can say is how much does the government give them.
Okay.
This is the way how it works in Cuba, and Cuban doctors earn somewhere between $40 and $50 a month right now in the system in Cuba. Now,
$600 a year?
When we talk about salaries in Cuba, wow. We always need to be aware that cash in hand, the paycheck, is not all they get. There are lots of side benefits employees get, and that includes doctors. They get some perks such as access to automobile purchases and housing and things like that. But to make a long story short, yes, their salaries are ridiculously low, as most Cuban salaries are. One interesting option for Cuban doctors is tens of thousands of them are being sent by the government, the Cuban government, to help patients in other countries. And the Cuban government, in many of those cases, in some cases it does it for free, in other cases where a country can afford it, it actually charges for the doctors. And in the case of Brazil, for example, there are 11,000 Cuban doctors working there right now. The Brazilian government pays the Cuban government $4,000 per doctor per month. And of those 4,000, an estimated 1,500 ends up in the pockets of the doctors
mm-hmm.
at this point. Well, now, this seems to be unfair, but $1,500 a month is enormous right now, and Cuban doctors are lining up to provide services abroad right now. They want to do that.
So the likelihood is things like plastic surgery, all these dental care, as you mentioned earlier, all these things are beneficial and interesting to people flying south in the wintertime to a winter vacation in Cuba. Low-cost dental care and low-cost plastic surgery and all the other accoutrements that U.S. citizens and North Americans generally would come to.
Well, yes, and I would add to that serious diseases. If you're a cancer sufferer, Cuba might provide interesting alternatives for you. And if you're an addict, for instance, Cuba has developed very effective anti-addiction programs.
Don't they have a history of dealing with AIDS differently than the other countries? I understand that they created an area, a compound of self-living, if you will, for people with AIDS when that was the epidemic.
This was in the 1990s, in the 1980s, when the epidemic first came up. Cuba reacted very drastically with isolation, but they've gone way beyond that today. I mean, there are pretty much part of the mainstream today, and AIDS sufferers are embedded in normal life. They live at home and they receive similar cocktails of medication that AIDS patients elsewhere in the world hopefully are able to receive.
Well, I know that in Costa Rica, and I've traveled there many times, you can, for $600 or to $1,000 a month, you can live in Costa Rica. At least that used to be the case. It's been a while since I've been down there, about 5-6 years. But you could have a home there, a condo or whatever, and become effectively, from a beneficial side, get free health care in Costa Rica. Is that going to be the competitive thing? And, of course, if two countries, Cuba and Costa Rica, become similar in that way, short flights from the Midwest and so on become a real draw, and that seems like it may end up becoming a real competition for what we do in this country, which we claim to have the best health care in the world.
I'm not sure what your point was, Augie.
My point is that...
What you're saying is that thousands of Americans will flock to Cuba and Costa Rica to receive free health care.
Well, they already have it available in Costa Rica for if you show an income available to yourself and you have a residency in Costa Rica, you can get their full health care system. What would Cuba do but just be a place without that involvement? And I don't know what Costa Rica does without your residency as far as the health care is concerned. But Cuba seems like it's offering something without residency.
It's a little more complex an issue for Cuba in the case of Cuba right now, in that there are relatively few long-term foreign residents there. You're more talking about short-term foreign visitors to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the practice is right now, Cuba won't let anyone suffer or die because of a disease if they're unable to pay. So if something happens to you while you're visiting Cuba, you are going to be treated, and they will probably try to charge you for the services, but that really differs from case to case. The general approach is if someone is seen as sick and suffering in Cuba, they immediately get help, no questions asked, and maybe then someone later will ask a question, well, could you pay something for that?
Mm-hmm. So that's
pretty much the current practice.
So illegals in the form of Americans or North Americans coming there, ending up getting sick, get free care, and a request to somehow donate to the cost. I mean, that's a real irony. It's the way we approach care in this country is it's just care for profit. And profit is in the... I mean, Medicare costs 4 pennies on the dollar in this country to operate it and run it, and it's 32 cents on the dollar for the private care from 65 backwards in age in the younger years. So our health care system is geared to profit, and the care in Cuba is geared to cost and providing the care more than anything else. It seems much more humanitarian.
That's right. And in the course of exercising their different values, they've developed an actually very cost-effective system. That's what Cuba is really a leader in providing preventive health care. They've emphasized that very much. The degree of education among regular Cubans about medical issues and health is very high, and they're very effective on delivering their health care services. So Cuba can actually teach a lot to the rest of the world.
We're speaking to Johannes Warner, and he's from the Cuban Standard, and we have to take a one-minute break. If you want to call us and talk to our guest after the break, give us a call at 941-745-1490. We will be back in almost 1 minute. Hopefully. Try it again. Come on.
I'm a try.
Oh, Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato. 4450 South Tamiami Trail, Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too. With the animals.
And we are back with Johannes Warner from the Cuban Standard. Did I say your name correctly?
That's correct. And the name of the publication is Cuba Standard.
The Cuba Standard.
www.cubastandard.com.
Mm-hmm. We've had some conversation a number of times about Cuba, you and I, Johannes, and we talked about the Manatee Port, and you came on and talked to Beskaitis, up here, who's the port manager, and this area right here is directly impacted once that port gets going, a deeper water port than it currently is. But then there was talk about high-speed ferries running from Manatee down to, like Fort Myers does, down to Cuba. So you end up having a customs situation right here in the Sarasota-Manatee area. That does spark a lot of interest. And in the wintertime, of course, people come to Florida for spring baseball. And I think one of the major sports of Cuba might be baseball. It is.
It's not a sport. It's politics. It's culture. It's everything.
I was being tongue-in-cheek, of course. What's going to happen when Cuba gets opened up as time wears on? And I'm sure Major League Baseball is scratching their head what to do if Cuba decides they want a baseball team or something like that.
Well, I don't think they're scratching their head. They're actually digging in their heels at Major League Baseball. There is a situation of brain drain is not the right word, but the best Cuban baseball players
talent drain
end up in Major League Baseball in the United States just because it is the best baseball in the world that's being played here.
Whoa.
And there's a very particular situation. MLB has insisted Cuban players have to defect if they want to join an MLB team. And that's brought about very bad situations for Cuban players and their families because in order to make it to the United States, they have to pass through a third country first. And in most of these cases, these are Latin American countries, and in most of these cases, in many of these cases, it's human smugglers, Mexican cartels, for instance, that get involved in the act. There have been very prominent cases of famous Cuban baseball players in MLB who have to fend off threats for their lives because the cartels are asking for a cut of their salaries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's behind this, and of course you won't find an MLB official saying that, is this is a great deal for MLB teams. If you want to get a player from, say, Japan or Taiwan or a talent from Venezuela, you cut a deal with their teams and with their baseball federation, and you will pay them a percentage of the contract. You don't have to do that with Cuba. If you tell them your whole system is illegitimate, we don't recognize the Cuban Baseball Federation, you have to defect first. So Cuban players become free agents, and they're real bargains,
mm-hmm.
given what they deliver.
So
that's where the holdup is right now.
So
Cuba, as part of its current reforms, has opened up. It has allowed its best athletes to perform abroad and join professional teams. And you have some great Cuban players playing, for instance, in the Japanese Professional League right now. You have some playing in minor league teams in Canada, ironically traveling to the United States and playing other U.S. teams. So you have, you do have professional Cuban baseball players playing abroad, and the Cuban government allows that and manages that. But you are still forcing Cuban players to defect if they want to play in major league teams.
So the politics, the international politics of becoming, basically dissing your own country in order to go to the United States to make some real money, is being facilitated by the drug cartels coming out of Mexico, who have an interest in the money of the contracts that take place in America. But if Cuba suddenly proposes their own baseball team, a major league baseball, and an affiliation to the United States, or an affiliation to Japan, for example, and say Mexico City does the same thing, suddenly the money factor changes the mix here, and Cuba would profit, and they would, the defection issue could really endanger, or at least make real, what we call the World Series of Baseball, which is a joke, and affect a lot of things within that sport.
Yes, it's actually much simpler. You know, you don't have to restructure Cuban baseball or Mexican baseball in order to make the system more functional. All MLB would have to do is recognize the Cuban Baseball Federation and negotiate with them and accept them as a partner in any deal they make in contracting Cuban players.
Yeah, but wouldn't they want to see the players making similar kind of salaries that they pay in the United States so that it doesn't create an earthquake there?
You mean Cuban professional teams playing high salaries?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, when you...
That's the way it is probably going to go. Cuba just increased salaries of quasi-professional Cuban baseball players, but the amounts they pay are still, of course, ridiculously low compared to what they can earn in a professional team abroad. So that's probably the direction in which it is going. But no matter how fast Cuba moves, there still is a canyon of a gap between what players can earn playing in MLB versus mm-hmm. playing in Cuba. I mean, you will always have that lure.
Well, if that defection issue gets dropped, then you're going to have a flood of Cuban players going north, or not.
Yes, that is true, and this is why the official Cuban policy is when you're a Cuban player, your talent, you want to play abroad, you want to make big money, your club abroad will have to allow you to play during the normal Cuban baseball season and to play for the Cuban national team in international tournaments.
Oh, so the backup is you still have to play in international tournaments, but you can go ahead and make your big salaries in North America.
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. And maybe the Cubans are going to move away from that stance of forcing Cuban players to play both in the Cuban league and in the league abroad at the same time, which is very straining, and it's going to cause injury. But probably they're going to insist at a minimum Cuban players, the biggest talents, will have to be free to join the Cuban national team in international tournaments.
Well, that does happen in the NBA right now. A lot of the NBA players play for their national team in the Olympics and things like that. So that's already happening. So in baseball, out of loyalty,
it is actually happening in baseball as well. I mean, Japanese players are free to join the Japanese national team during the World Baseball Classic, for example.
Uh-huh. Well, but if this thing starts to broaden out and deepen in terms of talent and interest, I think it will end up discrediting American baseball for claiming to be the World Series of that sport. And something else is going to be more interesting to people as more valid.
I don't know if I don't have enough insight into baseball to understand where this is going.
Well,
I mean, what's clear is that there's an untenable situation right now.
Sure. The other thing we've talked about, and one of the things, one little footnotes that came up in the exporting of the Cuban business and of medicine, and medicine, we're focusing on medicine because I think people are really very concerned about where medicine is going. And with Cuba's place here and what they've done and with other countries and trying to help, and what they attempt to do to do with Katrina, is what would you like to tell that story, Johannes?
Well, when Katrina hit New Orleans and people were stranded, literally stranded in the streets of New Orleans, Cuba offered to send their standby medical brigade. They have a medical brigade of several thousand doctors who essentially are waiting backpack packed at their side at the airport to be flown to disaster areas. And they've been flown to areas far flung from earthquake-stricken areas of Pakistan to areas in Africa, most recently Ebola. You have an infrastructure in Cuba that is ready to respond very quickly and very effectively in case of disaster. And so the Cuban government in 2005 offered the Bush administration then to send the medical brigade, and not surprisingly, the U.S. government refused, scoffing at the notion of having a third world country assisted in a disaster, but we know the outcome. I mean, literally thousands of people in New Orleans were stranded for days, if not weeks, and there were deaths and there was disease because of that. So Cuba has a particular strength in disaster medicine, and another particular strength is in general medicine in very difficult circumstances, and that includes poverty and underdeveloped rural areas. I think doctors emerging from the Cuban medical educational system are among the best prepared in the world to practice medicine in difficult circumstances.
To reinforce that notion, tell us what's happening with the education area of medicine as far as the United States is concerned. Are students coming to Cuba and getting their education there and being retested here and passing and so forth? Is that happening?
Cuba has positioned itself as a hub of poor medicine in the world, and they've created an international medical school. It's called the Latin American Medical School. It's in a suburb of Havana, and they graduate thousands of foreigners every year to become doctors and practice in their own countries, and that includes about 100 U.S. students at this point. These are mostly students coming from humble or low-income backgrounds, from rural areas, from neglected neighborhoods, that could not afford to study medicine in the United States. So the Cuban government provides them a full scholarship. They have to learn Spanish, and they spent four or more years in Havana studying medicine. And we now have the first graduates coming out of that system and returning to the United States. There's a nonprofit in California. It's called Medic with two C's. They actually provide scholarships for those returning medical graduates in the United States to have their degrees recognized and pass all the tests. So this is an interesting experiment. It remains to be seen where those U.S. Cuban-trained doctors end up and what they're going to do. But we see the first actual people emerging from that system.
So these are the first graduates, 100 new doctors coming to the United States, taking the tests here, having already have the advantage of the English language. Now they have the Spanish language under their belt. And they can work in all areas of probably any migrant society that's in the United States pretty effectively.
Or the native population. No, it is, nothing stops them from providing services. I mean, the Cuban government cannot tell those graduates, you know, you have to do this or you have to take care of that group now. It's pretty much up to each individual to decide how and where they want to practice medicine. But what's pretty clear in the U.S. medical system, there's a huge lack of primary care physicians, and particularly primary care physicians taking care of the Medicaid population or the uninsured population. And these doctors are particularly prepared to deal with these kinds of patients and become primary care physicians.
Well, if they have thousands of doctors that are traveling as a brigade to go to disaster areas, and Pakistan was one of them you mentioned, what is the relative patient-to-doctor numbers? How many doctors per five people or 500 people, or what is it?
The doctor-patient relationship in Cuba is actually among the highest in this hemisphere. I don't have the number right with me, but it is evident when you are in Cuba, when you're in a Cuban city or even in the Cuban countryside, there is always a clinic nearby on your block or in your neighborhood. It's always walk-in. You don't have to make lengthy appointment procedures. Lo and behold, there are even home visits by doctors. You know, I remember that from childhood, but we don't have that anymore. And Cuban doctors actually come to your home when you're sick.
Yeah, when I was in the hospital back in 13, late in that year, I talked to a nurse who had done midwifery, being a midwife, giving birth to children in China. And she stated that she had probably given birth to probably some, per year, 1,000 or more women. But the problem she ran into in the United States, and there's no system, I guess, between China and the United States that allows people to practice at their competent level because of the economic interests of some, that she couldn't afford to pay the cost of the medical stuff with the oversight of a doctor for a midwife. We have all these blockages in this country, and obviously with being a doctor and a doctor's degree and passing the test, Cuba kind of leaps over this hurdle a little differently.
Well, it's a totally different society. I mean, one of the biggest costs for practicing medicine for doctors in this country is insurance, liability insurance, for instance. And, of course, that issue doesn't exist in Cuba. The notion of suing your hospital or your doctor in court is not really known in that country. And it will be interesting to see how these U.S. graduates of the Cuban medical system will handle that. There are costs involved in practicing medicine that require you to jump through certain hoops and or charge your patients for it.
Well, some years ago, just after Jeb Bush as governor put in a law that limited the liability of a doctor in a hospital committing a damage to a patient, there was a patient who they cut the wrong leg off of in Tampa General, and they made a waiver right after. It was within months after that law passed the legislature, the ridiculous law. If we don't have free care, you can't waive the liability. But this patient got the free care, but he's still without. He lost the other leg already to gangrene, and ended up with no legs and probably some kind of part tacked on. But nonetheless, some millions of dollars were paid to quiet the situation down. So I think the problem in the United States, people, they talk about the liability of doctors and what they have to pay, but it's also what they earn. We have doctors here making millions, and Canadian doctors limited to $500,000 a year, coming down here to make more millions because it's available to them. But then they squawk about the insurance that they have to pay. This kind of thing starts to unravel in your face with the approach that Cuba takes. I mean, that's just a commentary.
It's diametrically opposed to the U.S. healthcare system, which is largely in private hands. This is public medicine, and there's only black market private medicine in Cuba. Officially, there is no private medicine practice.
Officially, but you say black market. Now, what would that be?
Well, that is if you're someone arriving with a certain condition and money, doctors will immediately turn to you because they will see a possibility of earning money under the table.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact as well in the Cuban system.
That happens in Costa Rica because I talked to a doctor who said, I'll do anything you want outside the system to make extra money. He just said that in so many terms to me. I was sitting watching a play in the National Theater there, and he said this to me in conversation. Amazing, bold comment in Costa Rica, which has free health care for everybody, too. This whole thing is... the intrigue of, and the curiosity that's going to be such. Cuba is a real magnet for a lot of things, and their orange industry. They have tobacco. What are their products?
Their first and foremost product is services, and particularly medical services.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually a big economic factor. They're exporting $8 billion worth of medical services every year. So that's actually the biggest export product.
Now the population is?
11 million.
11 million. So they're less, they're about 5 million under Florida. And the physical land size, if you flatten out Cuba, you're roughly the same size as Florida.
That's right. Yeah, it's like a mirror image, a turned Florida.
Johannes, we've got just a minute left, and I'm going to ask the last question. So if I want to go to Cuba to visit, what do I have to do in order to go to Cuba to be a visitor in that island?
On the Cuban side, you don't have to apply for anything. If you're just a tourist, you arrive at the airport, you pay for a visa, and you get your stamp. On the U.S. side, you have to prove that you're not having fun. The Obama administration has allowed pretty much any category of travel except tourism. In other words, if you go and come back and a U.S. immigration agent will ask you, where have you been? You say Cuba, and when the question comes, what have you done? You have to explain to them, I was there for religious purposes or educational purposes or anything else, anything but tourism.
But if you say you did have fun, what would be the penalty here at the United States level?
You'll put them in a tough spot because enforcement in the hands of the Treasury Department is fairly underfunded at this point. There are, I don't know, three or four administrative judges handling embargo violation cases. So you will get a case number, and if you want to be a lawyer later in your life or an elected official, it will be held against you.
Well, Johannes Warner, I want to thank you very much for calling in. It's always a pleasure to listen to you.
And we'll see you next month.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Johannes.
And that's it for this session of The Morning Edge.